Hey everybody, it's Nick here. Welcome to Scale Up for this week. Today's episode is going to be on the more practical side because we are going to get into one of the most important parts of mergers and acquisitions, and that is the due diligence process. Now, before you think, oh my God, this is going to be super boring, I just want to reiterate that whether you are buying a company or selling your own company, you are going to experience this often confused, but incredibly important, incredibly crucial part of the process. So just to be clear what due diligence is for those of you who probably have an understanding of it, but maybe not the detail. So whether you're buying a business or selling a business, there is going to be a process where someone wants to come and kick the tires on that organization before the transaction closes. Now, depending on the size of the deal, can depend, or some extent can impact the complexity of that process. But in any case, it's going to involve looking at financials. It's going to have a look at any legal issues that may be in and around the business. There's definitely going to be some commercial questioning that's going to happen. Sometimes it gets quite into the detail around employees, culture, who owns the intellectual property, all that sort of thing. Now, what I want to do though today is simplify that for you so you can understand exactly what you need to know and why. And in order to do that, I've invited Elliot Holland onto the show, who's an absolute expert when it comes to due diligence. Now, a little bit about Elliot. He is a Harvard Business School alumni. He has been involved in the world of small and medium-sized business acquisitions for some time. He's worked in private equity as well. And these days, he runs a firm called Guardian Due Diligence, which helps business owners with the transition of their companies, so going and having due diligence done on their business before they sell. He also helps business owners acquire companies and does the due diligence on those acquisitions.
Sometimes it's quirky and not a big deal, right? So sometimes there'll be companies like landscaping companies that don't carry inventory on their balance sheet. That's not that big of a deal. Double accounting depreciation, a pretty big deal. And sometimes even when it's wrong or inaccurate, it was not malicious by the seller. And so there's a lot of stuff going on in that mix.
So we're going to get into it today, but as I said, we're not going to go down the rabbit hole because it can become incredibly complex. We're going to cover important topics around what a great due diligence process should look like. And we're going to get into one of my favorite topics, which is called quality of earnings. And if you haven't heard of that, you're going to learn something very important today, because if you sell your business one day, you should definitely be doing a quality of earnings analysis before you sell your company. It can literally make millions of dollars difference.
What happens is when these buyers come to make offers, they get this report alongside it. They're able to bid higher because they have less concern about the numbers not being there. And then when they do whatever due diligence they actually do, when they have questions, you don't have to answer it, owner. Nick doesn't have to answer it. I get to answer those questions because I did all the detailed work.
So anyway, enough of me rambling about what this is and what it isn't. I think we should now join the conversation. So welcome to Scale Up with Nick Bradley, Elliot Holland. Hey everybody, it is Nick Bradley here. Welcome to another episode of Scale Up. And today we're going to get into a number of really interesting topics, some of which we haven't covered on the show before. So I am very excited about going into those. But the general sense, the general kind of theme of today is effective due diligence, particularly if you are selling your company. But we can also talk about it around if you are acquiring businesses, bolting them onto your existing portfolio. And with me, I have an expert in this space, Elliot Holland. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to have this conversation.
We said before we press record that we were going to try and make it interesting.
That's right. I'm not putting anybody to sleep, Nick. I promise you.
I don't think you will. But and I'm not going to go to sleep because I love this topic. And I'm going to impress on everyone who's listening today that if you have any interest in M&A whatsoever, be that you're going to sell your company, you're going to buy other businesses and bolt them onto your business, maybe you're going to sell your company and become an acquisition entrepreneur and then build an empire of businesses, you have to understand how due diligence works, because it's not just about risk mitigation. It's also about kind of looking at opportunities and things like that as well.
That's it. Yep. Perfect. It's a whole process and very important.
Love it. Okay. So let's get to know you a little bit more, Elliot. So let's give us your background and how you kind of got into the M&A space as well, please.
Sure. So I was an undergrad engineer, but my first job was in business consulting. And a couple years of that, I went off to business school. I was fortunate and got into Harvard Business School. And so I wanted to be rich like everybody else.
Can I just jump in quickly? Did you enjoy Harvard? Was it good? I mean, firstly, it's not easy to get into, is it?
No, it's not easy to get into at all. Definitely enjoyed it. And one of those like lifetime experiences, man, you can never forget it.
Love it. Okay. Sorry to interrupt there, but I thought like that's always interesting for people. Cool. So you went into, as you said, into business consultancy.
Yep. And then after business school, I worked in private equity. I wanted to understand the business of buying businesses. But I quickly kind of realized that owning your own company was a huge piece of really generating wealth. And so I kind of spun out of the private equity firm I was working for and worked with an older professional who was buying businesses. And then I actually bought businesses on my own. And what I saw was that the due diligence process for deals, call it under $30 million in purchase price, the diligence solutions aren't as great as they are for deals above that. And so around 2018, I started my current company, Guardian Due Diligence, to be a better due diligence solution than the ones that are on the market for deals under $30 million plus or minus to help both buyers and sellers get better transactions accomplished.
Fantastic. I can hazard a guess as to why that's the case, that due diligence below that level isn't as robust, mainly due to the investment required in, or certainly traditional due diligence is a capital intensive thing. But before we go into that and kind of how your businesses solve that problem, what was happening before? I mean, what does due diligence look like for a business that's say valued at, you know, 10 million, 15 million or less? What does that look like traditionally?
A lot of people are looking more at the cost than the value. Okay. And so what you hear a lot is, oh, this is a smaller deal, so I want a bare bones process. And, oh, well, we don't want to do that part of the analysis, or we don't want to do that. A lot of times, if you think about the best diligence processes, they'll have financial as the anchor, but they'll also have commercial and operational. A lot of people skip the commercial and operational. And so it's a lot of corner cutting.
Really? But so it's mainly financial and legal, what you're saying. So we're looking at the valuation of the business, let's say, purely through the numbers, not the asset value or anything like that.
Not the asset value, not who's working in the business, not how good they are at selling or what their growth opportunities are. And for deals 10 million and under, oftentimes the people who are buying them are more personally invested than even my fancy private equity friends who don't have a lot of skin in the game. So although the deal size may be smaller, the personal investment of the people, and so therefore the risk, is much higher. So the solutions don't match the risk.
Got it. So you're saying that you could lose some friends.
Yes, very easily.
I got it. And I've seen that too in certainly some of the businesses I've been involved in who haven't gone through or understand the importance of this. They'll go out there and they'll try and buy a business and they want to rush the deal. Right, they'll say, let's just get it done. I've seen the balance sheet. I've seen the P&L. You know, it doesn't matter. I mean, are there any situations where you think that's actually quite prudent anyway? Because let's say you're going to buy a business and you don't really care about how it's run. You just want to buy the assets. In that situation, I imagine it's less important or not.
If the seller's your best friend, if over 50% of the purchase price is in a seller note, if you've known the seller for 20 years, if you can mitigate sort of $10 million worth of downside risk by some piece like that, then maybe you don't need due diligence. But I would also argue, frankly, let's say we're best friends, Nick, and I'm buying your business. It may be more important that I do diligence on your business so that we don't have to stop being friends. If there's something that you didn't think was major, but I think is, I buy it, now I have it. And now our friendship is actually tainted. So I would say in most situations, particularly if it's over $1 million, you should really be doing the work.
Yeah, well, anything, $1 million is still a big amount of money to invest, right? In anyone's language, depending, it doesn't really matter what That's your right. net worth is. Okay, That's so right. let's go through, so I get that. I can see how traditionally, and I see it every day, people don't kind of understand the value. Take us through what you think the proper value of a great due diligence process is.
So there's a couple of pieces. The first piece is getting getting very good relationship with the seller and the seller's accounting team. Why? Because on smaller deals, who you're actually working with, how overworked they may already be, the timeline is so important. Second off is having a robust but not like ungodly long set of items that you need. Back when I was in private equity, we had 8 pages sometimes, 10 pages. My page is now 1 page. There's 40 items and half get taken care of if I get QuickBooks access.
So go back on that again. Let's go back on that again, because I'm with you on the, I still see the 8 page things like a lot.
In I'm my sure deals. You do.
But you said what at one, did you say 1 page?
1 page.
Really? And so everything's assessed, but you're giving them a scoring or something like that through the assessment. If someone wants more detail, they can get it, but you're focusing on the high level stuff.
We summarize questions in a way where I may get the answers to somebody else's 8-item list. I may get 10 answers in one question because I know how to ask it better. I also can have discussions around certain items that may be a 2 or 3 minute discussion with the seller that may take care of somebody's whole sales and marketing portion of their due diligence list. I also know that I can't get anything done when I send 8-page lists. And folks like you, Nick, don't like me very much when I send them. So
well, it makes lawyers very wealthy.
I'm not a lawyer. That's their business.
I'm not a lawyer either. But I've seen the bills that can come in when you start to get through, you know, massive data room investments and all that. Obviously, as you get up the chain and you start to deal with what I call sophisticated buyers, private equity firms, family offices, some of the biggest strategics, then there's governance processes around certain things. So the level of sophistication goes up because of that. I get that. But I do like the idea of simplifying the due diligence process so it's more usable, right? And people can understand it. Cool. Okay. Well, let's talk about it from the angle of sell side. So the majority of people listening to this podcast are business owners. And I would guess to say that the majority are looking to exit their company at some point, because that's what we talk about a lot here. Take us through what that process would look like. Imagine that I've come to you, right, and I'm going to get ready to sell my business, and I'm going to engage you to run a due diligence process in advance of a sales process and things like that. How would you do it?
Sure. So I'll just talk through what I'm working on now. So first off, 99% of the time, if you're doing financial due diligence, the service that you're getting is called a quality of earnings. It's just a mini audit on a private business because there's no real standards of financial reporting for private businesses. And both buyers and sellers need to understand the asset that they're buying. So you'd come to me for a quality of earnings. And what I would do initially is, let's say you're selling. I would say, hey, Nick, here's my due diligence list. 1 page, 40 items. I can knock half of them off if you give me direct access to your financial system. Okay, so half are gone. Yeah. Now let's work through the other half, put them in a data room. So we get the data room full. Then we go through our accounting analysis. So what we're doing is we're comparing 3 major data sets and reconciling against each other: taxes, bank statements, financials. So we go through that process. That's going to come up with a lot of questions. This didn't match that. Why? This is a little different than we anticipated. Why? We get through the questions and then we're basically done. At the highest level, that's the process, and that's what a quality of earnings is.
Got it. And how long would that normally take? I mean, obviously it depends on the business and what you find, but generally.
3 to 6 weeks.
Okay. Right. And what are some of the things you find that are, let's call them the quirky things within the process? Like I'll give you an example. I was looking to acquire a sheet metal business here in the UK, and it was owned by a family, three brothers and a father, and they decided to buy lots of racehorses on the balance sheet.
Okay.
So yes, you can imagine that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So like, and they were trying to sort of, you know, there was a conversation about, know, how that could then be written off and all these things. But what are some of the typical things that you see?
We find all kinds of stuff, but I'll give you one that's recent on my mind. We were doing due diligence on a digital marketing agency that should have been charging kind of monthly recurring and have, you know, like a 5 to 10%, maybe 20% churn on an annual basis. They had like a 150% churn rate. So it really was a project-based business masquerading as a monthly recurring revenue business.
What was the valuation methodology? Was it being sold on a revenue multiple? I know some agencies do still sell on revenue multiples. Were they trying to pigeon it like that, or?
It was a healthy EBITDA multiple, but one indicative of recurring revenue, not a crazy sales job.
Okay.
And then I had one company that was in the trucking business, and their accountant had chosen to not use US GAAP standard, not use the international standard. They had a whole new standard where they were double counting depreciation to get to a much higher EBITDA. And so we find all kinds of quirky things. And what I'll say, Nick, is sometimes it's quirky and not a big deal, right? So sometimes there'll be companies like landscaping companies that don't carry inventory on their balance sheet. That's not that big of a deal. Double counting depreciation, a pretty big deal. And sometimes even when it's wrong or inaccurate, it was not malicious by the seller. And so there's a lot of stuff going on in that mix.
Yeah, okay. I get it. Because I find it, particularly with the smaller businesses, you know, they're not of a scale to have a CFO or a proper finance team in them. They may have an accountant that's been their personal accountant or CPA for years. So there isn't a lot of business finance work being done whatsoever. And then you get situations. I looked at a business in Tampa once. It was a cafe business we were looking to buy. Until we went into the back room and everything that they had financially was in a drawer, in bits of paper. Right? Receipts, yes. Invoices, everything.
Yes.
I mean, what happens in that situation? Do you just have to dig in and try and find what you can? But you must get to a situation where there are significant gaps. And at that point, you must have to score the business a certain way, which is either a kind of go, no go.
Sure. So we try to stay a little bit before a go, no go, because at the end of the day, it's our clients who are making the $1 million decisions and taking on the $1 million risk. But what I do tell clients sometimes is saying, hey, there's no financial system. There's a bunch of paper. They're saying some of their bank shut down or bank account statements. I will do the best job I can with the data that's here, but I may not be able to give you a definitive answer. It'll be far better than had we not been in this project. But I'll be honest, it's not necessarily going to be a guaranteed definitive answer. And sometimes we kind of get through that malarkey. And then sometimes, Nick, the messiness of the system doesn't prevent us from getting to a solid answer. So sometimes I had an engineering company I did due diligence on who didn't have an accounting system, but had their invoices going back to 1992. Well, that gave you all the financial information you needed. And then they had their cost print out from Wells Fargo each year. That gave you all the cost side. And so actually, even though it wasn't in an accounting tool, it was very easy to reconcile actually.
And you could get to a decision or I suppose to some extent we're getting to a point where there's a kind of qualification of the value piece here, right? So, yes. And you know, in my world of private equity, you know, we would use retrading quite a lot through a more robust due diligence process. But the due diligence processes that we were doing were costing hundreds of thousands, if not millions, depending on the size of the transaction, right? Different specialists going in there, assessing IT and tech and IP and whatever. So let's talk a little bit about the valuation piece. Do you get involved in that with your clients as well? Do you do like a valuation in advance of a process if you're working on the sell side, or do you do a valuation on a business on the buy side if you're, you know, advising there as well?
So yes and no. The valuations for most of my clients are a multiple of EBITDA. And given the industry and the size, people tend to know what those multiples are. And so our job is to get to that EBITDA number that you're applying the multiple on.
Got it.
And so what we'll do is we may get to the answer and say, hey, look, that's a really high price or a high multiple given the EBITDA we found. But we don't do like the full on valuation piece because typically our clients are as good as at us at doing that piece. But we're so dialed in on the EBITDA. And then on the sell side processes, keep in mind, the owners are doing this sell side quality of earnings diligence to get ahead of any messiness before the private equity firm comes in to do the same evaluation process to make sure that the numbers are solid on their side. And so what we're trying to do is take kind of messy small company financials, create a very robust package that a private equity company can look at and say, oh, with this rigor, I can make a full price offer without having to go into all of this because they've already done the work.
Yeah, perfect. And that's exactly what I've advised many of my clients is the value. Well, there's two parts of this I think are important. If you show that you're prepared to do that level of rigor, if you like, analysis in advance, it shows a certain degree of professionalization of the business.
Yep.
I often say that speed kills all deals, or timing kills all deals. So the quicker you are, you know, at you know, being able to go through a due diligence process, the better, right?
That's right.
So let's go a little bit deeper into, I know you mentioned, you know, at a high level, what the quality of earnings is. But I know there are a lot of people here who are thinking, hey, you know, maybe I should be doing that. So go through it in a bit more detail if you can. So exactly what you're looking at and the different things, different elements.
So if I may, Nick, I'm going to explain the process a little bit so that I can zero in on what this tool does. So I want to sell my business. I go see a person like Nick. Hey, I want to put my business for sale. Nick's going to put together a package to go talk to people about that business. Now, he's going to do a lot of work to put your financials together. And then in a normal process without this, you would take that package to people who would make an offer on the business. And once the offer was accepted, they would have their crazy 6-7 figure due diligence team pick apart the financials of the smaller business to come up with their own view of it. Sometimes honorably, right, Nick? But sometimes maliciously, they're trying to find issues that are not issues to knock the price
100%,
down.
100%. And I talk about this a lot on stage.
You get paid whatever they think it's worth. So then let me adjust this process. So now you go to Nick and say, hey, I want to sell my business. He puts together the package. He takes your financials, put them in a clean report. And you say, you know what? I want an extra level of protection. I want to do a sell side quality of earnings. Well, great. I would come in and take what's probably 4 or 5 pages of financials that would be in Nick's packet, plus or minus, and I would go do a 30-page to 45-page report that goes through every single thing a private equity buyer, an independent buyer, a family office buyer expects to see and needs to see to make their decision. So then I'm talking to your accountants, I'm talking to your CPAs, your controllers, I'm getting all that together. And then when we're done, what happens is when these buyers come to make offers, they get this report alongside it. They're able to bid higher because they have less concern about the numbers not being there. And then when they do whatever due diligence they actually do, when they have questions, you don't have to answer it, owner. Nick doesn't have to answer it. I get to answer those questions because I did all the detailed work. And so it takes the seller off the hot seat in a major way.
Yeah, that's very good. And as we probably both know, that the distractions that can happen through a sales process when you're trying to run a business and keep it performing, you know, through what can be sometimes a 12-month period of time, you know, at the worst extreme, is not a good distraction to have by any stretch.
Exactly.
Okay, got it. Excellent. And so that piece, so I've you know, got my business ready for sale. I've engaged you. We have the quality of earnings. I take it within that you're also advising on any ad backs and normalizations and things like that. So we're looking to try and find the purest profitability that we can justify before going into the sales process.
That's absolutely right. And a lot of what we'll do is describe, understand, present the ad backs, the normalizations in the language of accounting so that accounting based buyers can see the one or two sentences, know what it is, and off you go. So we try to simplify the process for everyone else involved. And then the ad backs, the best buyers are going to want to see those receipts, those line items on the general ledger, a bunch of stuff I don't want to bore you with, but we do it with smiles on our faces. So you guys don't have to do it. And you can just have the conversation about those big Brinks trucks that show up when these sales happen.
Well, exactly. And there's nothing, as we said from the very beginning, there's nothing boring about this because there are literally millions of dollars sitting at the back end of this work.
And everybody loves the Brinks trucks. Yeah.
Well, they're exactly right. And the ad backs thing's interesting because I've talked about it a little bit on the show beforehand. People don't understand that. I had to explain it to one of my clients once. And then he thought that it was a good idea to go to nightclubs and buy bottles of champagne as client entertainment, thinking it's all a big ad back. And I kind of said, you've got to be a little bit careful with that. But the point here is there are expenses in your business today that legitimately can be added back to the profitability of your business because they're either one-off expenses or they're not a kind of a going investment to keep the business performing, growing, or any of the sort of legacy performance. And so when you add those up, they can be substantial amounts in their own right. But then you put a multiple on top of those. Let's say it's a 10x if you're in a certain size business and you've got, you know, a million of ad backs, that's $10 million you've just added to your payday effectively.
Yes.
Crazy.
That's why you get guys like myself involved in these processes to shore up those millions of dollars of ad backs to get the 10x or $10 million of purchase price. And frankly, to be arguing less with some buyers who can be a bit cantankerous around some of this stuff, frankly.
I agree. Exactly. Particularly if they're negotiating with someone who doesn't know what they're doing and they can take advantage of that for sure. Again, without going too much into the boring detail that I love, can we talk a little bit about working capital?
Oh, yes.
Good. I thought you'd like that. This is the other sort of contentious area. So whenever I get involved in negotiations, ad backs get negotiated a lot because it's a bit of a justification for certain expenses. Working capital obviously is what remains in the business to keep it a going concern once the transaction happens. So when a deal is done, for people who don't understand it, you have a cash-free, debt-free position, which basically means any debt that's in the business needs to be paid off through the transaction. Equally, any cash in the business gets taken, you know, by the owners of the business, except for working capital. How do you, right, Elliot, assess what a reasonable amount of working capital is in the business? I expect it changes, sure, depending on the industry and whatever, but how do you go about that process?
So generally, we like keeping it as simple as possible. So we would look at the balance sheets for a 12-month period, and we will take the average of current assets. Remember, cash-free. So we're not looking at cash, but all the other current assets minus current liabilities. So what that means is there's no debt, but accounts payable and some other things. We net those out each month, so 12 months, and then we average it so that the new owner can finance the business once,
yep,
and get all that he needs to run the business versus buying a business and then having to put the working capital in. And nobody likes that second loan, and it kills a lot of deals, honestly. And it's also a discussion around the seller recognizing that businesses are traditionally sold with working capital and making sure that's a really clear piece of the letter of intent and sort of the expectation set up front.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. And it is one of those things that can be, I remember when I was on the private equity side of things, we would use that as a negotiation point quite a bit. And we'd always be trying to take as much as we could through the negotiation, right, to de-risk any other investment we had to put into the business. So it's something that a lot of business owners need to educate themselves on and understand on either side, the buy or the sell side. Cool.
Totally agree.
Cool. Okay. So let's talk just a little bit more about the broader due diligence process. We've kind of gone deeper into the quality of earnings, which is a key piece. Sure. What are some of the other things that you kind of, I kind of want to get into a bit of like the watch outs, right? So when you're, sure, doing a due diligence, you see these kind of, let's call them things that start to bring the value of a business down, that if a business, sure, owner knew about them in advance, that they could do something, yep, about. So what are some of those watch outs?
One is key man risk. So how mission critical is any one person, typically the seller, to the operation of the business? And that has a lot to do with sales, relationships, any proprietary IP or knowledge of how things work, any of those things where a single person has all of that kind of in their head, and whether they're going off to the Bahamas after the sale, or they could hit the lottery or get hit by a bus in any given day. If one person could totally throw off the value of the business, that would reduce the value. Something else is if the financials are in such disrepair that it's hard to believe them. Like, it's one thing to have sort of typical small business financials, not a CFO, that's fine. But if they're so nasty, that brings the value down. Reliance on one vendor or one customer. So if a large portion, call it over 40% or over 60% of your revenue, or if your purchases come from one entity, such that a bad day with that entity or that customer, or a change in price with that entity or that customer, can totally swing the profitability, that brings your business down. Those are some of the main ones that come up again and again and again.
Got it. And in terms of mitigations for some of those, let's just talk about the suppliers for a second. Longer term agreements in place, anything that you can push the potential issue or risk down the road is what, right, we're looking for here.
That's one. The other one is, if you know a year before you're selling that that's what you're doing, you may overpay a little bit to get another vendor into the mix so that you've actually identified the issue and partially solved it for the seller, or for the buyer rather. So that when you come in, it's not 60%, it's closer to 40, and it's on a trend that somebody can see it going down to 30. And now you sort of solve the problem for the buyer.
Yeah, you've diversified the risk. Get it. And back to the key person piece. Let's say I'm gearing up to sell my business, and you know, I bring in a CEO to run it 18 months before a sales process, because I didn't want to hang around that much when I sell it. I want to probably be just an advisor or something. Sure. What sort of things have you seen that work well in then to kind of retain that person? Obviously, if someone's sticking around, they probably want to benefit from a sale. But how about incentivizing them post-transaction? Have you seen any clever ways of doing that? Or is it just contracts and bonuses and things like that?
I think it's primarily contracts and bonuses. But let's take a step back and say, on this, let's be smart. So owner, you should recognize that a big piece of bringing the CEO in is that they transition with the business in your stead when the time comes. So it's a single day kind of huge risk for you. You shouldn't have probably paid them if they weren't going to do it. So make sure their agreement has whatever transition bonuses, selling bonuses, ownership, so that you have the discussion when you hire them on and the expectation is set, not at the closing table. And then buyers recognize that as much as the seller promised this person something, I've known a seller or two to not pay out on those bonuses. And so you need to be thoughtful about what you're willing to do to keep this person. And in a lot of transactions, that person is part of the negotiation. And so you're going to have a chance to talk to them or have an employment agreement negotiation with them. And so showing them how important they are to the business is mission critical. So both the seller and buyer honestly have huge responsibilities in this transition to make it clean.
Yeah, I've personally been involved in that through two private equity transactions where, you know, the main actual conversation was with the buyer, you know, and in the negotiation around what was going to keep me to stay. So I was incentivized to stay around for a year and do the integration. Right. But if they wanted me to stay longer term, they had to put a package in front of me that was exciting enough for me to be able to make that choice. So yeah, I fully agree. Okay. Excellent.
And okay, I think a lot of buyers sometimes get penny wise, pound foolish on that. So they're thinking about market-based rents and how it's not rent, but market-based wages and how it's going to affect their DSCR and coverage ratios. So they need to think about both the market rate for a position, but also the value that a solid, consistent management team brings to their overall value of acquisition over a longer period of time, and be willing to sort of negotiate in that zone.
I think the other thing is there's a metric in private equity, I'm sure you saw this, where when you swap out leadership and put in your own person, that the general return on that is pretty high. It tends to be the case. And so I've had fights with private equity firms around consistency and stability versus change and transformation, if you want to call it that. And sometimes right. Those arguments aren't always won. Cool. Okay. Understood. Well, listen, let's finish off talking a little bit about the market as it is today and what you're seeing. Sure. I'd be curious because you're involved in lots of transactions. Let's talk about it from some of the small businesses. So a lot of people listening to this show are also looking to acquire small businesses and bolt them onto their existing business. What are you seeing in terms of the market now? Is it starting to become more congested with more acquisition entrepreneurs going out there? How's it looking, the landscape?
Sure. Admittedly, I think it is more congested, but at the same time, in some ways, it's less. I'll give an example. So with a lot of acquisition entrepreneurs coming into the market, what it means is the absolute volume of buyers is higher. And so you have to sort of do something to differentiate yourself. However, in that same zone, a lot of those folks are on the lower end of the age spectrum in their career. And so I've had a client recently who's in his 50s, where he was almost every seller's favorite buyer because he had made money, he had run companies, he had a bit of age on him, he presented that way. And so even though it's a crowded marketplace, there's a lot of things, I just gave you one example of things that you can either do or be to differentiate yourself, to be very different than the swath of folks that are coming into this.
Yeah, I get it. And I take it, there was a thing a few years back now around all these no money down deals. I mean, obviously we talked a little bit about seller financing and that. Are you finding that there's more of a awareness of that by the smaller business seller? Meaning that, you know, unless I'm massively distressed, I'm not going to entertain that. I expect you to put a bit of skin in the game, or I expect you to find some money from somewhere and et cetera, et cetera. Sure. Are you seeing more of a shift in that direction too?
I am. I think when the market wasn't as advanced and wasn't as known, I think the no money down deals could pass sometimes because people didn't know. I think more people know about them now.
Yeah.
And also I think the skin in the game concept is real. I also consider just no money down deals speculative. I think, you know, on a great day with the perfect sun, perfect weather, you know, your perfect family with you, you can get something done. But when you try to line up 20, 30, 40 perfects over $1 million, I can just show you a graveyard of people who have tried that dozens of times and not made it work. And it just wastes a lot of people's time and energy. And in the States, there's so many programs to help people find the money. I think the no money down stuff is speculative and oftentimes not worth the juice isn't worth the squeeze.
Yeah, I call it needle in the haystack stuff. And the other thing, remember, I tend to work more on the sell side, and you know, some of the business owners are in their sort of 50s, 60s, some 70s, and they've spent, you know, 30 years in their business. And I often say to someone, I said, you know, who we had this conversation on other podcast guests, and say, do you realistically think that someone who's had their business for 30, 40 years or whatever is just going to give it away for nothing or some risky kind of deal, unless they're sick or something's happened, which again is the needle in the haystack? They ain't going to do it. They're going to be offended, and you should be ready for them to be offended.
And I'll add on to that. And I work for the buy side. So again, this is speaking against my client's interest in some ways before the betterment of good deals, which are tenderly the ones that get closed.
Yeah.
So you have 2 to 4 months of time to execute a transaction, and you have to line up 30, 40, 50 things at a good line of negotiation where the buyer and the seller accepts. When you're bringing this no money down crap to the table, what ends up happening is the first thing that doesn't line up, the seller's gone. And so then what did you do? You spent months and time and conversations that the first time something didn't line up because you were getting such a great deal on paper, it didn't make any sense for them. So again, part of the skin in the game is getting people to get past some of the inconvenient things that happen during a buy or sell process.
Yeah. Well, when I do work with Carl Allen's guys, and he's got quite a sophisticated network now of investors that have come mainly from real estate. So they have quite a lot of cash, right? And they're doing deals where they're putting 10% up to 20% cash into the deals. They're obviously leveraging different loans like SBA, but they're turning up and they're doing good deals, good transactions, and they're legitimate, right? And a lot of them have got some form of business or financial background, et cetera. And they're having consortiums where they've got other expertise joining. So the thing I'm seeing is that, like, if you turn up trying to do a no money down deal with no experience and everything else like that, some of the stuff that people teach in programs, you're up against some pretty decent, let's call them acquisition entrepreneurs now, who have the resources and you know, they're the ones that are going to get the good deals for sure.
And let's talk about it in simpler terms. So like Warren Buffett gets great deals all the time. You're not Warren Buffett, right? You know, Jamie Dimon at Chase, he can get a lot of deals done because he's been in the banking industry forever and he runs a multi-billion-dollar, trillion-dollar bank. You can't walk in the game thinking you're going to get the same terms as somebody who's been doing it for 20, 30 years. And oftentimes people with a bunch of wealth don't have to put as much in because of their relationships, their experience. If you're getting into the game new, it's a very different thing. And again, I never said that the no money down deal doesn't exist. I'd be silly to say that. It's also a game that more patient, wealthy people can play better because they can be more patient. Folks who are trying to get, you know, make their bones, right, and make some money, don't have the ability to wait 4 or 5 years for a needle in a haystack to come by.
No, exactly. You're 100% right. Out of all the transactions I've been involved in, I've only ever done one that's been no money down, and it was a super distressed deal, right? And it was kind of lucky the way it happened. So I would never build a business plan around that being a scalable option. Cool. Exactly. Well, listen, Elliot, it's been awesome having you on the show today. So thank you very much for sharing your wisdom. I really appreciate particularly the depth into the quality of earnings, as I mention it all the time with people, right? It comes up all the time. And now what I'm going to do is point them back to this episode and say, do you want to understand it a bit more and why? Then listen to this. Perfect. So where can people reach out to you if they would like to work with you or get any kind of understanding about kind of some of the stuff we've discussed today?
Sure. Go to Google, type in Guardian Due Diligence or Elliot Holland, and you'll find my website. I'm also at Elliot E. Holland on Twitter and at Guardian Due Diligence on YouTube. And I'm very active on both of those socials. So please reach out. I'd love to support you in whatever you need around due diligence and quality of earnings.
Perfect. We'll make sure we link those into the show notes. Is there, just as we finish up, is there any, you mentioned deals obviously below 30 million. Do you work with any bigger transaction as well, or is that really just not the area that you're focused on?
Sure. 10% of our deals are somewhere between 30 million and 120 million. So we get relationships or certain deals that make sense. I try to use my marketing language to be a bit more specific than all the stuff that I do. Yeah. But yeah, so we do some above
that. Okay. That's lower mid-market type of activity as well. So I take it some of those, the question behind the question was, some of those transactions are into what I call the proper private equity firms as well. And certainly negotiating and liaising with them.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, good. All right, Elliot, thank you very much, sir. As I said, we'll point people in your direction. It's been great having you on the show today. So thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, thank you for listening to this episode of Scale Up with Nick Bradley. If you enjoy the show just as much as I enjoy creating it for you, then I'd really appreciate you leaving a 5-star review wherever you listen to your podcasts. And while you're there, why not subscribe to the channel so you never miss a future episode? It really helps me, it helps the show, plus it makes it easier for others to access the content that I'm producing week in and week out. And finally, if you want more information about anything you heard in today's show, or to find out how you can get more help in scaling up your business and your life, click the link in the show notes now to learn about our coaching, mentoring, and mastermind programs. See you soon.